So, guys, hello and welcome to tonight's guest speaker. We have, as Tom has just said, Verity on with us tonight, who lives with type 1 diabetes. And Verity is a fantastic person to get to know. I cannot wait to hear her story. So, I'll just give you a little insight into Verity, and then we'll get in, and Claire will go in and do the 90 seconds round, and we'll start jumping in and getting things into the good stuff. So Verity was on Channel 4 Make Me Prime Minister. She is also a renowned feminist along with a social justice warrior.
Oh.
So love that for us. Something I'm sure we're all very passionate about here. I'm going to say this as well, I'll be probably jealous. If you want to check out what Verity does, you will see if you go on her Instagram account, because you've got to stalk people a little bit to find a bit of information about them. Apparently, Verity likes to do a lot of travelling, and there will be a few questions around about this, because it is something I'm sure we all know and love with diabetes, is trying to travel. So Claire, if you are ready to pop on and start the 90 seconds quick fire round, and then we will get into the fun bit after that.
Okay, I'm ready. Hi, Verity. Can you hear
Hello.
me okay?
Yeah, all good.
Right, well, this is termed the 90-second question, but it normally lasts about 15 minutes, but we'll try and get through it quickly. So, question one, what is your name and occupation?
30, and I'm international cabin crew.
When were you diagnosed and how old were you?
I was diagnosed in July 2020. I was 20.
Do you finger prick or use smart technology?
Smart technology, Dexcom.
When you did finger prick, did you change the lancets every day?
No.
Don't think anybody does. Do you use insulin pens or a pump? And what do
Insulin
you prefer?
pens at the moment.
Okay. What do you prefer? Would you rather go on to a pump?
Yeah, I have a pump appointment in December.
Oh, we'll look forward to hearing
Yeah.
about that. Are you hypo and hyper aware?
Yeah.
And if so, what symptoms do you have?
I get really moody when I'm hyper. Like really, really grumpy, really awfully grumpy. And I get really cold when I'm hypo. Like I go quite blue. Yeah.
Okay, what is your go-to hypo treatment?
Oh, Percy pigs.
What do you think is worse, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
Hypo, definitely. Yeah, hypo.
What is one thing you like about diabetes and one thing you don't like about diabetes?
I think the community, the friends, the people you meet is great. I think the stigma around it is the thing I dislike the most.
Yeah, I think that's the same for a lot of us. Next question. Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
I don't really mind it. Yeah, I don't really mind it.
Okay, and the last question. If you're on a desert island, what three things would you take? We'll give you all your diabetes equipment, so you needn't worry about those.
Probably a map. I don't know. I might steal a survival pack off the plane. They've got everything in them. They've got your emergency like communication thing that you can sit in the water and it'll send out a signal. Yeah, might just steal the emergency survival pack on the plane and a water bottle.
Okay, thank you for that. We've got to know a bit about you. I'm going to hand back to Gary now, who's going to carry on with the rest of the evening.
Thank you, Claire. And hello, Verity.
Hello.
And I have been messaging you, so I'm going to do the apology. I know we had an earlier date set up, and I am sorry that we muddled up dates. So I do apologise for that, because the community were really looking forward to getting to hear your story and all your journey with diabetes. Because obviously we heard Natalie's side of the story and how you were really friendly on Make Me Prime Minister. So we really want to get to know more about yours and your understanding and how you feel about things. So I will say that you have got me for the next couple of sections, and I love a good gab. Do not be scared to tell me to shut up. Do not be scared to tell me to shut up. So I will say as well, I am grateful that somebody has said when they're hyper, they get so grumpy, because I swear I could rip people's heads off sometimes when I'm hyper. I'm like, I'm going to choke you if you don't get away from me. And it's just complete and utter grumpiness, and I see red and I cannot get by it.
Yeah, so and then my mum will go, check your blood sugar. And then I'm like, no, I'm fine. And I'm not very good at kind of letting someone else be right. Yeah. I have to prove that I'm right. So I then have to be like, I'm not very good at kind of backtracking and eating my hands, being like, yeah, I won't. I just have to be like, no, I'm fine. And then I have to walk away and just pretend.
But you know that you're not. You're very much like me. Somebody else, and I see red when somebody says, you should check your blood sugars. And I'm like, how dare you tell me how to manage this? I'm the one that knows what they're doing. Even although I know that my blood sugar's high, and I'm like, I can't backtrack, because I know that they're actually right. But I'm telling you, you're not right until I'm telling you it was. And then I'll wait like an hour and I'll be like, oh, it turns out my blood sugars are high just now. That must be why I was grumpy earlier, but they just weren't ready to peak to that point. They were just starting. And it's just so that I can save face. So this wee bit here, we're just going to go through your diagnosis and your journey just now with you. Like, and I know that you have recently just had your diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. So it will be nice to hear this perspective of someone that went through this during the pandemic and the sort of support that was available, or if there was any support available at that moment in time. So can you just share with the community your diagnosis with diabetes and like how you were diagnosed? We obviously know that you were 20 when you were diagnosed, but what were your warning signs? What did you notice, or did somebody else notice it? Things like that.
I just got kind of progressively worse over like a period of time. And then one day, you know, COVID was here, but the hairdressers had just opened.
Yeah.
And I remember texting my mum being like, I really don't feel very well. And she was like, you can't cancel your hair appointment. So I sat in the hairdressers for like 5 hours. And I have quite a fear of the hairdressers now, because how they managed to cut my hair straight when I just kept like going to the side and like almost collapsing but not collapsing. I had really bad chest pain, I had heart palpitations, I was like really clammy. And then my mum's a nurse, and nurses are the worst for going, no, I think you'll be fine. She did it when I had sepsis. She was like, no, you'll be fine. And then she was a bit like, oh shit, actually, we should go to the hospital. And she did that when I was diagnosed. But obviously, I wasn't allowed to take anyone in with me. So I went into A&E on my own and packed a little emergency bag just in case, but left it in the car and went in, and they were like, oh yeah, straight through. And they were like, I had really bad heart palpitations and chest pain, and I couldn't breathe and I couldn't catch my breath. And then, yeah, they just kind of did my bloods and they were like, is there any chance you're diabetic? And I was like, absolutely not. No chance. And then, yeah, 6 weeks later on intensive care, there I am, type 1 diabetic. That was it, really. So, yeah.
That sounds, do you know, that sounds super, super, like, scary in the perspective of, because when COVID was happening, like, I don't think I would have coped being sent into any hospital myself without somebody there to support me or be a support network. Did you find that challenging? Because obviously, I know that you've said your mum was like, yeah, you'll be fine, don't worry, you'll be fine, because she's got that nurse mentality.
Yeah.
And it's the indestructible, because she's like, oh, you're just, it's nothing, it's probably just a cold. But how did that make you feel? Because I'm assuming that, like, not having your mum there must have been quite a trauma for you, in terms of, because she would have understood it more and been able to set your mind. Not that I don't think that your mind is clear, but I think when you're getting diagnoses like type 1 diabetes and things like that, you get lost and miss out in all the vital things, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, what was just said to me?
I was given, I wasn't actually given my diagnosis for the first like 3 days that I was in hospital.
Yeah.
I went in, obviously, I was on majors, and I just kind of remember sitting there texting my mum, like, reading, you know how you're like under your name, it kind of says the what you've got. And I just remember seeing like DKA, but not knowing what it meant. So I just said to my mum that I thought it meant like they hadn't found what it was yet. So I just was like, oh yeah, they're still doing tests. And then I got more cannulas and more like lines. And then they took me up to intensive care. And I remember like I was wide awake. It was the middle of the night. And I was like looking around at all these people with all these like breathing masks and ventilators and all these things. And I was like, I'm not this ill. Like, I'm really not this ill. And then I had to have, and then like in the middle of the night, this surgeon came down and gave me like 2 femoral lines, one in my neck and one in my groin. And then, yeah, I was given a lot of potassium because I was on the verge of a cardiac arrest. And I just kind of remember just sitting there being like, just want my mum. And then my mum had to book in for an hour. She was only allowed an hour a day. And I just kind of remember sitting there on my own being like, shit, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't see my mum. But I had the most incredible nurses. They were so wonderful. They were so kind. They'd always like, they'd go to Costa and they'd buy me something, or they brought me a card and they'd plait my hair and they'd just look after me when my mum wasn't there, which was really sweet. And then I spent 6 weeks on intensive care. And like,
do you know,
6 weeks, and they became a little family, really.
Yeah. Do you know, it's great that you had nurses that were able to help you and be supportive with you. And it's amazing just how caring nurses are, even in times of distress for them, where the world was going crazy and we never knew what was happening. It's nice to know that they were still going above and beyond and going that extra mile to look after patients.
Yeah.
And it must have been traumatic, because in intensive care units at that point, a lot of people that were in intensive care units were COVID patients. So going in and seeing people in ventilators and breathing apparatus must have been a very kind of scary experience, is the only way I can describe it. It must have been petrifying, that ultimately, because you, as you're saying, you don't feel like you're that unwell, but they're deeming you that unwell enough to put you in a room in an area of a hospital that's for intensive care unit, basically. So it must have been very, very scary, and I'm sorry that was the experience you got. And at that time, because obviously COVID wasn't fun for anybody, but being in a hospital ward where COVID was prominent must have been like traumatic at that point as well, because you just didn't know what's happening at that point, and nobody knew what was happening, really.
Well, I had sepsis, so I was in septic shock 6 months before, and I was in the hospital that saved my life, because I went to another hospital and they sent me home with period pain. And, you know, by the time I was blue lighted to another hospital when I had sepsis, they were like, we've got 10 minutes. And I felt safe because they'd already saved my life. I knew I was in capable hands. I knew that I wasn't going to be let down. And then, like, when I saw my mum, she'd come in and she'd be like, oh, your GP rang today. Like, my GP phoned my mum every day, 6 weeks, phoned my mum every day to see my progress.
Yeah.
Because he felt so guilty that he didn't find it. Because where I'm a celiac, I've always had, like, my blood sugar, HbA1c, has always been tested just in case.
Yeah.
And it's always been, it's never been over, but it's always been on the slightly higher scale. And he felt so guilty. And I feel very lucky to have a doctor who took time out of his day every day to phone my mum to see my progress, who now I go into the GP and he's like, you make an appointment for her. If she needs to see me, you make an appointment, you find time and I'll see her. Which I think I'm very lucky. Not many places get that.
It's far and few between to have a GP like that nowadays. And that is down to GPs are just overworked and overstretched, and they do struggle. So it is great that you've got a GP that is able to offer that for you and support you and also check in with you. Because I think the first... living with diabetes is complex. Like, it's not, nobody's going to say it's not, and anybody that does say it's a walk in the park, I want to know what your secret is, because if you're finding this a walk in the park, I need to have a bit of what you're having, because it's 24/7. But see, having the first 6 weeks, having somebody just check in and make sure how your progress is going on and just making sure you're okay, that takes a lot of pressure off, because you feel like you've got that healthcare professional and you've got somebody that's really wanting to make sure that they're setting you up in the right path to help you understand the condition a lot easier and navigate life a little bit easier without all the additional thoughts and strain that goes on top of that. So it is great that you've had that opportunity. And your GP is so good at just keeping up with things and making sure that you're in tip-top condition, basically.
I think, because it wasn't always... It was so wonderful of him to phone my mum, and, you know, I'm very grateful that he checked in and made sure that we were both okay.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, the thing with COVID, and especially getting a diagnosis in COVID, is... I found that I was very much swept under the carpet. I was completely forgotten about. I didn't see my consultant. I didn't see a diabetic nurse or a dietitian until the end of 2022. That's 2 years into my diagnosis. And I've got them going, oh, well, you're not very good at this, are you? You haven't done that. And I'm like, look at, and they're like, oh, when was the last time you saw someone? And then they look back at records and go, oh. And realised that the last time I saw someone was when I was lying on a hospital bed.
Because there was no appointments, you were just kind of, you were flung a set bait, and this is going to sound bad as if I'm saying nobody done their job right, but you were flung a couple of pens and some needles, and then a repeat prescription was basically wrote for you and told, this is what you need to do and this is how you need to do it, and then nobody really thought about
they didn't think about the complications of it, you know.
Yeah.
When I was diagnosed with celiac, everyone was like, oh, you've got to cut out gluten. Here you go. And I was like, oh, okay. But I'd still eat a biscuit, or I'd still eat, you know, I'd still go for something that had gluten in it, because no one told me. And it was like, you kind of would swing back to your old ways of life where you just wouldn't inject. It hurt. I didn't want to. I was covered in bruises.
Yeah,
I didn't want to do it, so I had gluten in it because no one told me. And it was like,
and I think
you kind of would swing back to your old ways of life where you just wouldn't inject. It hurt. I didn't want to do it. I was covered in bruises. I didn't want to do it, so I didn't do it.
And I think that as the
can't get them right because they haven't spoken to my celiac dietitian, and it's like so many different people, And it is what it is. You just have to deal with it. You know, yeah. I can't remember my life before I was a celiac. So I taught myself to bake, and you know, I make a lot of my own food now. Yeah. Like pasta, bread. I taught myself to make it all, cakes. So I know what's going into it. So I can then ratio myself, yeah, because I know what's going into it, and it's a lot easier.
And that is great that you've been able to do that, and you've found a way. It must be so challenging, because diabetes is very numbers based. It's very carbohydrates and your carb ratios and understanding fat and how certain things work in your body and how they adapt and change. And from what you're saying, it's like both of these are very complex conditions, and trying to master a carbohydrate ratio when you're removing things like gluten, it must be very challenging, and it must have a profound impact on like certain things that you eat as well, and at certain times of the day that will have an impact, and it must be so challenging. And I mean, I could not imagine having to try and handle two conditions that are basically full-time work, no matter what you do. I mean, I'm just amazed that, I mean, I barely scrape by in life as it is now with diabetes, so I'm amazed that you're able to do it with celiac and diabetes and still have a thriving life and a job that's, like, amazing. And that is the next thing I want to go on to, is, like, your journey with diabetes. So how has technology and all of this been beneficial for you, being an international flight attendant and getting to cross over borders and all around the world? How do you find living with diabetes and the technology and all of this, and going potentially like from one time zone over to another time zone? How does all this work for you?
Honestly, I'll just say that things don't work at 40,000 feet.
Yes.
It does work, but it doesn't work at 40,000 feet. Yeah. And, you know, people, like, 40,000 feet in the air and you've got your Dexcom alarm going off, people are like, what's wrong with the plane? And then you have to try and explain that it's not to do with the plane. And it's just your blood sugar monitor. And they're like, what? Especially if there's a language barrier. Like, I was on a flight to Mumbai the other day, and there's quite a language barrier going out from Heathrow to Mumbai.
Yeah.
And trying to explain that it's fine, there's nothing wrong with the plane. It's just like a sensor, it's just a sound that is keeping me alive. People, they don't understand it, because we are so lucky to have the technology that we have, that you kind of forget,
yeah,
that places like Mumbai, they don't have that technology. And like coming back from Mumbai, so going through the security in Mumbai, my Dexcom kept setting the metal detector off, and it got to the point where the lady was like, I'm gonna have to strip search you. And I was like, it is just my Dexcom, I promise you. And like, obviously as crew, you're on such a tight like time frame, yeah, to get to the plane, to do your security checks, to get people boarding, that I'm like trying to find my in-flight lead, like, Alice, come and help me. And literally the lady was trying to pull it out. I was like, you really can't pull it out because I need it. But it's actually a CAA regulation now, is that any pilot or any crew that are diabetic have to have a CMG, is that what, yeah, they're called? Yeah. We have to have one of those, and we have to check it every 2 hours. And we are allowed, like, you're allowed double liquid allowance because you're allowed to take your insulin and things, which means that, you know, I can stick a few more toiletries in my liquids, which is great. But yeah, the CAA are so like, this is what you have to do. And you know, every briefing they're like, okay, Verity, have you got this, have you got that? And then obviously you're kind of passed over to Medlink, which you can contact at 40,000 feet. And if you've forgotten your insulin, then MedLink will find your prescription and they will have one for you as soon as you hit the tarmac in another country, which is incredible because it means that you can do it for any passenger as well. So say you're flying to Hong Kong and you've realized that you haven't got any insulin on you, then one of the crew can contact MedLink and then they can go, okay, we can get an emergency prescription and it can be on the tarmac for when you land, which is incredible.
Do you know what? I never knew that, and that is phenomenal. And it is great that there is services like that, because do you know what? Sometimes you just do forget to pick up medication. Yeah. Sometimes it's the last, you think, I'm never going to forget that. So you leave it in the fridge and then you get to the airport and you're like, uh-oh, I have to get insulin. And you're like, crap, what do I do? And it is great that you can do that. Let's hope nobody needs to do it. But it is great that there is a service provided like that that allows you to be able to get access to things. Mm. And it is fantastic that you are able to do that. And it's also good that it's available to yourself, because sometimes when you're going to work, you do forget things. You're like, I'll not. And you're like, right, don't forget that, don't forget that. Then you run out the door and you get to work and you're like, oh, I've left my insulin at house. So it is great that it's also offered to you as staff members as well, which is fantastic. So I'm also, like, I've never thought about as well, I'm also amazed because I know that technology that we have, we are very lucky in the UK that we have access to all of this technology. But I've never really thought about going, because I tend to, like, it's, you fly to America where diabetes is prevalent, so everybody knows where it is, albeit border control is still a problem when you're going through airport security because they just still don't care. They're like, no, you can take it off, and you're like, no, I can't take it off, and that's not going to happen. But I had never really thought, like, going to certain countries where technology that we use isn't readily available, they don't really have a full understanding of. And when there is that language barrier, they don't really have a full understanding of what the technology is for, potentially, and trying to explain it. And it can become difficult when there is that language barrier. So you've just made me really kind of think, like, well, that must be difficult to try and do international flights where one minute you can be in America, the next minute you can be in Hong Kong and all of these places where certain things aren't available, and you're having to have conversations with people that potentially are looking at you thinking, what are you talking about? What, it can come off. So, like, I've never thought it from that perspective, and it just amazes me that you're able to navigate life and still and manage to do it. Because I mean, it's only just a new thing. I think pilots with type 1 diabetes are allowed to fly now, but that is only just a new thing, and that just, it amazes me because it's just, it's something that is just, is phenomenal that it, that people are looking at the condition and starting to see, well, wait a minute, it doesn't stop you from having jobs like pilots and that. It's just, there's a slightly different approach to how we do it, and it doesn't stop you being an international flight attendant. It's just, how do we approach this in a different mannerism, and how do we help this employee thrive in this industry that they want to be in? And I think that's, it's amazing to hear about all the progression that's happening in jobs like this. So that's something that just amazes me.
It is incredible. I was looking at a pilot scheme, and you know, at first, I know for a fact that the CAA give you a medical, and then they'll say that you are, they don't say you're unfit. They say that you can fly, but you have to go through a harder medical. So they want to see, I think they want to see like 9 months like blood sugar readings. They want to know like an in-depth, how you deal with a hypo, what are your signs, what are your symptoms?
Yeah.
But they, as long as they are comfortable and you can prove that you are controlled enough or that you have the technology to allow you to be controlled enough. They are very much like, okay, you know, it's just like driving. If your blood sugar gets too low, then hand over the controls. You know, it's very, very easy, I think. I don't know, for pilots to kind of hand over the controls. They're in constant communication with you.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. And I think it's a big thing. And I read something about Diabetes UK saying it's quite a big thing to allow people to be pilots because it shouldn't change the jobs that we want to do. I think there are certain jobs, you know, you can't join the army and that's never going to happen.
I mean,
because you're more of a risk to them.
Yeah.
Whereas on a plane, you know, you have everything readily available.
Yeah, definitely.
I need sugar, food, water, toilet. Yeah. You know, it's all readily available.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'm going to be the controversial one here and say this. For me, I'm quite grateful that I don't need to join the army because if you ever have to be called up for national service,
I
just don't think I could handle the pressure. Army life and like I like my leisure's
12 and then I was diagnosed with celiac, and because the celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, you're not allowed to join the army because you're more of a risk to them than what you're actually doing. So I lost my army dream when I was diagnosed with celiac, so it's fine.
Do you know, it is heartbreaking. See, if you've always wanted to do a job like that, it must have been heartbreaking for you because you had that dream of being a paramedic in the army. But do you ever feel like somebody was direct, there was a redirection of your life at that point? Somebody was saying to you, this maybe wasn't the right job for you, and they sent you into this field that potentially you never wanted to do, but now you're in it and you love it, and it's like who can say they get to see all over the world and they get to travel the world and see multiple different cultures and different perspectives in life? I mean, that is like, that's a dream job for many a people. If I thought I could be a flight attendant, I would do it, but I've not got the mannerism for it because I'm too I'm too straight to the point, I'm too cheeky, and I'll be honest, if I don't like somebody and I feel they're giving me attitude, I'm right nippy and I'm like, yeah, I'm not taking this. Away you go. So I couldn't do a job like that, but I would die for a job like that because it would be some. I would love to be able to travel the world and just see all different perspectives and all different cultures and how the world just operates. Because it from and ultimately even from certain parts in the UK, things work different and cultures work different, and it's just phenomenal to see and get that opportunity to see it as well.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, as much as it is sad that I never got to be the army gal that I wanted to be, I got the redirection, and I just have always cared about cultures and life. And I was talking to Nat earlier about going to Mumbai and just like seeing the slums and things like that always makes me want to work with charities more and do more because, you know, I just want to help people. I just want people to know that actually I think we should leave the world in a better way than how we found it. And I think the redirection I got from my diagnosis was, you know, I managed to meet some really incredible people. Like, you know, Nat is one of my best friends, and I genuinely couldn't have done half the control or half the life that I've had if I didn't meet her in it. Yeah. And like my best friend Josh, I met him just after I was diagnosed through Instagram, and genuinely he's like another family that I never had. And that's the redirection you have to look at. You have to, like, I've got a totally different value of life now. I appreciate what I have. I look at where I can help and where I can make a difference, but I still get to live my life as well and make the most of it, and like know that tomorrow isn't promised, and we're very lucky to just be able to go out and grab life and just live. And I think, you know, I actually quite appreciate my diagnosis in a funny way.
Do you know, it's lovely to hear that. It's like looking at the positives of things, like finding the benefits. You made friends, and your friend Josh, you met Natalie, and they've been able to shape and guide your life for you a little bit more and help you navigate two complex conditions, plus navigate life and help you achieve things and find things that you never thought you wanted to do or that were possible. And that is something that is lovely to hear. And like from the conversation we could hear when Natalie was talking about how much love and respect she's had for each other, because Natalie was basically blowing your trumpet when she was on, and how great you were and how committed to things you are. And this takes us on to the next bit, which I had a good browse through your Instagram. Some of the pictures, I'm not going to lie, I was very jealous in some of the pictures, because the locations look beautiful, and I'm not going to lie for a minute. But I also had a look through your Twitter and things like that, and I'm just amazed. Can you share, like, all about your feminism and your social justice cases and all of these things that you love, and your little joke in your bio on Twitter that says your friends just think you pose in a suit and argue with people? How does this all connect in, and what do you take from your celiac and your diabetes and that to make these, to help you fight on issues of feminism and social justice and all of this stuff? Do you use anything from your conditions that you've mastered, that you understand or you've learnt about? Do you use any of that in these sort of topics that you're really passionate about and your political standpoint in that? Do you use these topics to advocate for everyone like that's living with celiac and type 1 diabetes and things like that?
I think I was very, very loved by my mum. She's my best friend. And, you know, my mum has loved me for both my parents. I grew up with an older brother who's on the autistic spectrum. But I always had a lot of pressure of Verity's going to go to uni. Verity's going to, you know, my dad graduated Oxford with a first and is incredible with what he does. He just necessarily wasn't the right man to be a dad. And I always grew up knowing that I was second best to my brother. And I think I just learned to stand up for myself. And, you know, I argue like my father and he doesn't really like that, but I'm just as strong-willed and determined as my mum. And I think she kind of instilled that in me to really go out and just take everything with two hands and grab it. And if you don't like something, then try and change it. And I think why I kind of push for, and I like the political side of things, is because as someone in, you know, you are diabetes, there's so many people who are diagnosed with it around the world, you are still a minority group, that to be able to advocate for not just those who are diabetic or celiac, but those who are going through something, you are a voice of reason for not just those who fall into the diabetes category or the celiac category. You are a voice for those who have MS or another autoimmune disease, or, you know, there is someone that they can look at and think, actually, you understand my point of view. And I grew up not really having someone understand my point of view. So I wanted to kind of bring a voice of reason for a lot of people. I wanted to be someone that people can go, actually, no, she understands. She knows what I mean, how I feel. she knows that, you know, this is what she believes in, and actually I back that. I don't want it to be all, you know, everyone's the same, let's never think about disabilities or those who have additional needs. Like, I want everyone to be treated as a whole person rather than a disability or rather than a gender. I want people to be looked at as whole people by giving them a whole person experience, allowing them to have a voice. Even if they don't want to speak, they've got someone who can be that voice instead. And I think, you know, being part of these communities allows you to do it even more, because you just kind of, you know, that you can be a voice for so many people, and people sometimes don't feel like they have a voice, and they should never feel like that. And, you know, Nat was absolutely my voice in Make Me Prime Minister. Honestly, the girl, like, if she saw them run for a snack bag, she knew, and she'd be like, hang on, I'm coming too, or is she okay? You know, and you just kind of have to just want to leave the world better than how I was brought into it. You know, it's not the best place to be, but yeah, I think we can make a difference in some way. We should be people's voices. And
yeah, you can hear the passion in your voice, and you know, it's something that is phenomenal, because we do need more people that are willing to fight for social justice, fight for feminism, but also understand that boundaries have to be broken as well, because we have got such a diverse world, we have got such a interconnected world, and we have got so many different perspectives and so many different views in it, and we need people in the world that will look at all of these views and not make judgment based on gender or sexual orientation or race and things like that. And that is something we do need more people in the world that are willing to stand up and say, no, that's not fair, and that, and calling it out and helping give people that have a voice but potentially are scared to express that voice and share things. So having that person like yourself and like Natalie, who are willing to stand up and say, well, hold on a minute, this is what needs to be done, and this is what is happening in the world, and this is the changes that we should be seeing or fighting for. And you can just hear the passion, and it is so lovely to have someone that has that passion. So I want to ask a little bit in this bit as well. So we do know that you were on Channel 4 Make Me Prime Minister, and we know you were on with Natalie, and we did ask some questions around about that. How was your experience on the show? How did you find it? Was it daunting? Did you enjoy it? Was it something that challenged you? Or did you just think to yourself, I can do this and I know I can do this good? Or was it something that you looked at and thought, I want this challenge in my life because I want to see how far I can push things? So how did that go for you?
It was interesting. And, you know, I will always say this, and I think people get a little bit bored of me saying this, but I didn't have the best start. Nat and I, we had, you know, there was a lot of confusion about, I remember meeting Nat for the first time, and we got given lunch, and Nat said type 2 diabetic. And then I didn't get anything to eat because I just remember we went off and we did filming, and this happened like 3 days running where they just didn't cater. And I just remember kind of being like, oh, and being very well. So like, I never thought that I portrayed myself very well in like the first episode because I didn't get fed. So I had a few hypos and a few issues where we had to cut, we had to stop filming, and then we had to order like Uber Eats some food over. And I remember at certain points just being like, I'm actually not sure I can do this. And I don't regret it at all, because it makes me say to each other, being like, oh, I'm not sure this is the right thing. I'm not sure we've made a good decision. There is as well, and how you could make a totally different TV show with all the camera film, like all the filming.
Yes.
But it pushed me, and it made me realise that, you know, in a room full of people, especially in the first episode, if you've seen it, I get like more and more passionate, and I get more kind of not frustrated, but I get more opinionated, and I'm like, right, okay, well, this needs to stop. We're on two different pages here. It was a shit show. And I remember Darius and I argued, and I remember them going, guys, cameras are cut, and we would still be at it because we didn't agree with each other.
Yeah.
And so, I got more comfortable as the time went on.
Yeah.
But it made me realise that you don't have to be the loudest voice in the room, but you need to make sure you're heard.
Yeah, so
you
definitely.
You don't have to kind of go against everyone's wishes or make a decision that's going to impact everyone. You don't have to do something that makes you like a dickhead.
Yeah.
You just have to make sure that if you've got something to say, go out and say it, and really just be passionate and believe in what you're going to say.
Yeah. And I will say, I did watch it, and I think that you've done a wonderful job, and I'm sure everybody in the chat thinks you've done a wonderful job as well, because it is challenging. It's, you're basically getting pitted up against powerhouse people. So putting it as viewing for yourself, and Natalie, if you'd to put yours two together, probably the show would have lasted for a whole episode, because it'd be like, yeah, they two are the winners, and we need to let it go, because they're coming up with the best arguments for this, and they're actually working with one another to make it the change. So I do get the whole perspective of why they're saying that these were never paired together, because it's about having two very strong people that can fight the case for things. So I do think you've done a wonderful job, and I enjoyed watching you on it. So, and I'm sure many other people did. So that's a good thing for you to know, because I don't really engage much in TV, because I'm one of these people that I'll be doing like 90 million different things whilst watching TV. But I did manage to watch TV whilst you were on, and whilst Natalie was on, and I did enjoy the show. So we did ask Natalie about the food situation. So see for yourself, see when, obviously not taking your celiac into kind of consideration, obviously not eating for 3 days is challenging for anybody, but somebody living with diabetes who does run the risk of low blood sugars, high blood sugars. And also, I do understand that with celiac disease, it's like eating gluten actually can cause flare-ups in the intestines, is, I think it is.
Yeah.
And can have severe consequences on yourself. So how did you manage to navigate through that and get people to listen to you and understand the importance of why you were asking for gluten-free diet?
I think we ended up with a snack bag. We had a Sainsbury's bag that was full of gluten-free snacks, and it was 30 snack bag. And it got to the point where there needed to be something. Because, yes, you know, we didn't really get set breaks. We just got told when the camera crew had had it, like, when they needed their break, we got a break. But that means we could be going for, like, 5 hours. And it definitely got to the point. Nat was my biggest backing during this. Nat was like, no, actually, she needs this. Or I remember her talking to, like, Tia and like all the other guys that were like are kind of the team.
Yeah.
Nat would definitely be like, no, but Verity needs this, or we need this, we need to have this accessible. And she was definitely she's a massive part to play in why I all of a sudden started to get fed. Luckily, obviously, you know, we all had our own little apartments and they did do us like a food shop. But even then, I got into my food shopping, unpacked it and was like, okay, guys, you need to come and take half this stuff away because I can't eat it. I'd be like, well, I need something else. I think we definitely lived off, and Nat, I'm sure, will agree, is we definitely lived off of a lot of Uber Eats or Deliveroo. It was definitely a text of, what does everyone want for dinner today? Write it down and tell us where it's from and we'll order it. But yeah, that's what we, you know, it is what it is. But it was great because you didn't have to cook for however long.
Silver lining.
But yeah, you just, I think you kind of get bored of being cooked for.
I think it's the whole, you miss doing it for yourself because, and I'm assuming for yourself, you must enjoy, I'm using the word enjoy, I don't know if you do, but you must get enjoyment from cooking because you know what you're doing and you've taught yourself and you've understood how to make things like cakes and breads and these sort of things that help with your celiac, but also will have an impact on your diabetes and hopefully help it in a way for you. And I think that's like having somebody else cook for you takes away some of that passion that you've got and you're like, yeah, I don't want to go back and do this now. So I can see your point from that away. And I'm really glad to hear that you did have someone like Natalie who was able to help and advocate with you for yourself, but also advocate for everyone on set, because I'm sure you've all helped one another, and it's nice that you've managed to find somebody in the show that understood what you were going through and had passion to help as well. And it's phenomenal to hear such great stories about that. And I am sure that Natalie will be listening into this with a big smile on her face when we say we all heard when Natalie was on her chat as well how passionate she was, but how much of an advocate she was for everyone, not just for herself, for the full diabetes community and people outside of the community, like going to what you were saying. So it's nice that you've met a friend that has core values the same as you and beliefs in a system of belief that all it takes is one person to raise their voice and say, this is where the injustice is and this is what we need to do. Mm. One voice can change the world. And that's ultimately very true. And that saying is very true. One voice can change the world. And all it takes is that one person that's willing to stand up and say, no, enough's enough. So, yeah, it's fantastic to hear that. I think that another great thing that everybody likes to know about is just, and this is the last bit we're getting into, is just more round about mental health and peer support within diabetes and the diabetes community. So what does mental health to you mean? Looking at it from the perspective of within the diabetes community, celiac community, and how do you protect your mental health? What do you do to make sure that you're keeping your head space in a good place and you're not getting into, which I'm sure we all do, getting into these rabbit holes where we end up in Google and we're basically falling apart and things are happening that aren't actually happening because we've found ourselves in a dark place because Google told us that was what was wrong with. What do you do to protect your mental health around about that sort of stuff? And from all the stigma that's flung out about not just the diabetes community, because I'm sure there's loads of stigma about the celiac community that comes out as well. What do you do to protect your mental health around about that?
I think more recently I've kind of just been doing just what I love. I used to figure skate as a child and I just kind of I just got to like competing level and then decided to stop. And I've just kind of gone back to it and I've realized that it's just home. It's like a peace of mind. It's where nothing else matters. There's no judgment or anything. I think it's hard because I very much believe that, you know, we are part of these communities and we know that, you know, I can lean on Nat if I need some support. Nat, I remember, was filming the last episode of Make Me Prime Minister, and I remember FaceTiming her and she's like, I was in hospital and I like had sepsis and DKA, and I just remember like her peer support and just her being on the other end of the phone, but knowing, you know, it's really hard. Like for my mum, she's great and I love her so much, but she doesn't understand sometimes. It's nice to have someone who understands, who can just go, it will get better. I know how you're feeling. Or like, I remember saying to Nat, oh, I might just not take my insulin for a few days because I need to fit into a dress. And I remember her kind of being like, yeah, well, this is, you shouldn't do that because it's not healthy. And
yeah,
it leads to a bad path. And
yeah,
you know, she's always there. You know, I just know that she's on the other end of the phone. And it's the same with Josh. And I think as a community, I think that's for everyone. Like, you know, I say it to everyone that my Instagram or my messages is just always open. I could be on the other side of the world, and if something happened to Nat, then like I would be on the other end of the phone. I would pay £25 for an hour worth of Wi-Fi if something happened to her, because I would want to make sure that she's okay. The same with like Josh and just anyone. Like, it's such a shit hand that we get dealt.
Yeah,
but you know, the people in it are the reason that I think everyone keeps going. I think that, you know, it is like, I remember meeting Nat for the first time. She was in her blue jeans, her orange blazer, her white crop top. And I remember seeing her sensor. And then I was sat with Adam on the sofa in the green room. And I was like, are you? And she was like, yeah, are you? And I was like, yeah. She's like, 15 years, and you? And I was like, yeah. And like from that moment, my world changed, because you just kind of can sense people's vibes, and
you
kind of gravitate towards the people who understand the condition you live with. And, you know, I can't imagine my life before diabetes now. But I was saying to my mum that I didn't actually, before my diabetic diagnosis, I didn't actually really have many friends. That sounds really sad and really lonely. But like, not in that way. I just kept myself to myself. I did what I did. I was passionate in what I was passionate with. I was more mature for my age, and I just didn't really fit in.
Yeah.
And then I got my diagnosis and things kind of started slotting into place. And as much as there is the shit side of diabetes, you have to, I think it's all about, like, for me, mental health wise, it's like pulling out the positives. It's looking back at the memories that Nat and I have made, or that Josh and I have made. And you just realize that you've kind of got this extra little family who understand.
Yeah.
And you have someone else who, in a world where you feel like no one understands, someone else understands. And it's great, because you just have to remember those little things. Yeah.
And do you know, it is basically, you've hit the nail on the head there with it's remaining, looking for the positives and keeping yourself positive, trying to find the positives and keeping that wee bit of positivity in yourself about diabetes, because it is a crap card to be dealt, and let's not paint it any other way. It is challenging. It comes with complexities. And it also comes with, it opens up doors to other things, like what you were saying, where Natalie says to you, oh, that's dangerous, it can take you down a path. I'm sure a lot of people in this chat will know that path that it is, because a lot of you have been down that path. I went down that path for a very long time and now live with the consequences of not listening, and not listening to other people, not listening to doctors, not listening to friends, not listening to people with the condition that were telling me all the risks that I was taking, because I wanted to be skinny. I didn't want people to associate me with diabetes, because everybody always just assumed it was you were overweight, or you were this, or you were that, or you were this, or you were that. And it was trying to remove, because that stigma's always been there. There's always been diabetes stigma. And when it's reinforced, and then you've got like tabloid newspapers reinforcing that horrible stigma back out and saying, and putting the blame on people for a condition that nobody chose. And no matter what type you are, whether you're type 1, type 2, LADA, Moody, anything in between, nobody chose this condition. We never self-inflicted it on ourselves. But the media portraying it as if we all done this to ourselves, it just makes it challenging. And I think that you can end up in a place where you think, and I'll say the word loosely, it can put you into like eating disorder states sometimes, because you think, oh, well, if I just don't take my drag, I can lose like 20 pounds in literally a day and a half, 2 days, because I'm going to run DK. But you don't think about the consequence at the opposite end yet. And I think that's, it's great that you have somebody like Natalie, who is a great peer support. And Natalie is phenomenal. If you want to ask her questions, I know that she's always willing to try and help as much as she can. And if she doesn't know the answer, she'll help you find an answer, or help you point you in the direction of an answer. And that's what we love about the community. The same with yourself, Verity. If people want to ask questions, you've said that you're more than willing to always, your DMs are always opened, and you're more than willing to always help people and help guide us or point us in the direction, or just be there for somebody if they need something or they're worried about something, having that little like safe space to go. And that's what's great about the community. So final question, and then I just want to ask another thing. So this is the final question in this bit, and then I just want you to ask, you to go through the thing about the Medilink after I've asked this question, just for anybody that's recently come in that's maybe missed the point where we were talking about it. So what do you hope for the future of diabetes? What do you hope to see change, or what do you hope to see progress in the world of diabetes and celiac as well? It can be anything you want, or just in general life as well. It can be just on your general life. What do you hope for the future?
I think I would love to see more progression. You know, the incredible science behind all of the things that they're doing with diabetes is amazing.
Yeah.
And I got a ballot place for the London Marathon to run for the company JDFR.
Yeah, Mary works for JDFR. Mary, yep. Who I don't know if she's still here, but Mary does work for them.
I would love to, you know, see more progression with the kind of things that they're doing about creating a world without type 1. I think we can do so much with organs. And I remember my consultant saying to me, he goes, he was just like, please let yourself be angry. If you feel like you need to be angry, because in a world where science is so incredible and it creates and changes so much, the one condition that it doesn't ever change is diabetes. He's like, and he sat there and he just looked me in the face and he said, with cancer there's a chance you can fight, you can go into remission, or you can kill it. And you know, I'm never ever ever going to say that cancer isn't awful, because it is, but he was very much like, you have to remember that your condition isn't something that right now realistically is ever going to get a cure.
Yeah.
And I think it's just all about the destigmatization. You know, the things that Nat does with Dexcom and the just being open and talking about it and making people realize, like, I have people go, oh, you can't eat that. And I'm like, if I want to eat a bag of icing sugar, I just have to give myself the right amount of insulin.
Yeah.
And yeah. And they're like, oh, but you can't eat that. And I'm like, yeah, but don't tell me what I can and can't eat because you're not me.
Yeah.
And it's like fighting back what people think. I think I want people to be like, I'd love for people to be louder about saying no and arguing with what someone says, not arguing, but just like disagreeing.
Yeah.
What someone says, like if someone says you can't eat something, you know, I as a person will go out and prove to them that I can eat it.
Yeah. Yep.
Because you're telling me that I can't do it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not allowed to because I have diabetes. Then I'll be like, well, no, I can do it. I just will give myself the right amount of insulin. Like it's no biggie. Just like destigmatize, I think. I wanna see people be louder and prouder about the fact that we live with this condition. You know, just be proud that you do the job of an organ, you keep yourself alive, like give yourself a pat on the back.
Yeah.
We do it all. Yeah. We do the job that not many, like, people don't really have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, just be proud of that. And if you have a shit day, have a shit day. Because one shit day does not mean you're shit at what you're doing.
Do you know, I love what you've just said there. And I love that your specialist has also said to you, allow yourself to be angry. I think that a problem with diabetes is we don't want to see, we're always bombarded with numbers and we always see numbers and we don't want to feel like when you look at a number that's not right, we don't want to feel like we're failing or we're doing something wrong. So it's like we don't want to view a number that's not where we want it to be, and I think that we don't allow ourselves to get angry with it because we then know the aftermath of that, because we're then going to go into a state of where we're going to be like, well, I can't be bothered doing this and I'm just going to do what I want, and then the consequence of that is that you're chasing a number again and you're like, yeah, I can't do this today. So it's just I just love that whole thing. Now the final thing that I just want to ask about again is, there has been a couple of messages round about it. Can you just confirm again what the MediLink is and how it works? Just should somebody, because there's a lot of people on Diabetes Chat that do jobs that require them, like yourself, maybe not so much international flight host, but Mary, I know, travels a lot. Tom travels a lot. Can you just let everybody again know what MediLink is and should there ever be an emergency, how they go about asking about this? Should they have forgot their insulin or medical supplies that they require? Like, what do people do about that just to ensure that they can get the help and support they need and have access to the life-saving insulin that is required that for them as well?
So just kind of I do actually, Mary tweeted and I did say that I would do some more research tomorrow because I'm going into work tomorrow about it. But you can, if you just kind of let the crew know that, you know, if you kind of, we all do it where we get on to, I do it even as crew, like I get past security and then I'm like, I get into the cabin and I'm like, oh, have I got everything? Oh shit, where's my passport? Like we all get off a plane and we think, have we got everything? And if you haven't, and you realise that it's missing, just let one of the crew know. And then we speak to the captain, we speak to like medical, so MediLink or MedAir, and they are very quick to be able to find a prescription or get you a, if you say what insulin you take, how many units you normally take of it, or if you've even got a picture, we're very quick to write down what insulin it is so we can get you as close to that insulin, and you just like we do a lot of talking through the headsets and finding out. And then normally they'll just have something like sent to your hotel or on the tarmac for when the plane hits the tarmac. They're incredible. They're great.
Yeah.
You know, if you had a medical emergency on board and you had glucagel, and you were with friends and family, but you were collapsed, they'd be like, get them to administer it, because as crew, we're not allowed to administer it because it's a medication. So yeah, we're only allowed to give it once we've called for a healthcare, once we've called for friends and family. So, you know, if you're with someone and something happens, always make sure they know what to do, because they will be able to do it quicker than crew, because we have to protect ourselves, but we have to wait for the go ahead from someone else.
Yeah.
Obviously, 40,000 feet in the air, like if you're flying over South America, you could be 7 hours without a hospital. So it's all about making sure that we do everything we can to protect you for when you land. And then basically, good travel insurance. Your travel insurance will pick up the cost of getting you that insulin. And Medlink will just go through and communicate with them.
Yeah.
Medair, whatever. Depends who you fly with, depends who you use. But they're just there. And, you know, if someone's forgotten any pain or drug that they need to keep themselves alive, you just do the best you can to get it for them. I always carry a spare pen with me just in case.
Yeah.
And just in case I lose one or one doesn't work. But I always carry three because, you know, I know my friend Josh, he forgets his left, right and centre. And I'm like, well, I've got one. And as a diabetic, you know that if someone else is on that insulin, you can kind of, you know, if it's the same, say you're all on Fias, you can just go, well, I've got a spare pen, I've got enough. You can always, you know, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. It's about, it's prior preparation. It's the six P's. It's prior preparation prevents poor performance. So, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just about you being prepared and other people being prepared, that should something happen, if you've got medicine that somebody else can use and that is what they use, it's about being able to say, look, I've got enough to keep me going. Here's something to make sure that you've got enough to keep you going.
Yeah.
And I think that is, it's fantastic. Now, I just want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. I know I did take you over a little bit of time tonight. I do apologise, Tom. You know, I've not been on for a couple of weeks and not had a chance to speak. So catching up on all my missed words. It has been a complete and utter pleasure to have you on. And Natalie, thank you for joining in tonight. It has been a pleasure having you listen in to Verity and hear Verity's side of the story of what you were telling us about when you were on Make Me Prime Minister, and like and hearing how much you helped Verity. And also hearing how much Verity helped you as well. It's been fantastic to have you on. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Is Tom, has anybody got any other questions before I let Verity go and do what she wants to do? Is there any other questions kicking about, Claire, Tom, or anybody?
I just think it's been a really interesting chat, and it's interesting to see how you sort of manage with your travelling and your busy lifestyle. It's great that you were able to find a dive buddy in real life at the on the show, and it's really changed your life in terms of having good friends and people that you can really rely on. And do you think your experience on the show would have been completely different if you didn't have someone like Natalie having your back? And we talk about our friends, our dive buddies, basically having our back because they just get it, they understand it. And like you kind of were saying, she was there like fighting the corner with so many things, not only for you but other people, but in particular diabetes. Do you think it would have been a different like experience if you and Natalie weren't then. And how cool is it you're both on the show and you both had diabetes? Like, that's just wow.
I do. I think if Nat wasn't there, I don't think I would have even lasted past episode one. I think I would have been like, nah, this isn't for me. I can't do this. Which makes me really sad because I'm not really a person to give up. But I would have let kind of everything, you know, I was quite new into my diagnosis and I was still quite frustrated by it. That I was like, yeah. If Nat wasn't there, I would have been like, right, nah, get me home. Yeah. Get me home to Wes.
Like, you know what I mean? Safe. No, like you said, you were recently diagnosed, but like going on the show and then going through some of them sort of situations you're in where they weren't accommodating food and things like that. In it must have been so challenging. And just having someone there like Natalie who just got it. And I liked how you said when you were going off, like having a hypo and stuff, and Natalie, the crew were going to get stuff, but Natalie was there as well, like, I'm coming. Like, it's just great. Yeah. It's just people that really just get it, you know what I mean? And that's just so, so powerful.
Yeah. And you know, when someone just feels like, you know, they understand you because they've got it, Nat just kind of felt like that safe space. I knew that if something was going to go wrong, then a lot of the time they would go to Nat. They wouldn't go to the medic. They would be like, Nat, what do we need to do? And Nat was just there. She was just great.
Love it. Love it. Anna says, now I want to be a flight attendant. Is it too late for a 64-year-old to apply? Verity question.
No.
Mark.
Do it. Oh, my God. Do it. Yeah.
Imagine a team of... Gary was up for it as well. We'd be a right crew, wouldn't we, if we're all same flight.
I'm there. I'm just like strolling through the airport in my heels, loving my life. Get in that briefing room, get on that plane, and then you get to destination. You're like, this is so worth it. Because you're
I don't know if I could do the job. I've got a bad attitude for people that are not very friendly or kind to people. I've got a terrible attitude towards them. But my problem would be I'd probably never have a wage as well because I'd hope that you got to go through duty-free all the time. I'd probably spend all my wages in duty-free. I'd have no money. I'd be coming home and be like, crap, I need another job because I'm spending all my money in duty-free.
Yeah, we do get to go through duty-free.
Yeah, no,
Gary,
it wouldn't work.
You'd be talking too much, Gary. You'd only serve one customer. You'd be talking, man.
Tom... Customers would love me, but see the ones that were nice to me, they'd love me. And I'm a great salesman. I worked in cosmetics for many a decades. Previously, before I'd done HR and stuff like this, I could sell anything to anybody that they don't need because it's just about the charm. It is the charm that you've got to put on. You're like, oh, that colour would look lovely in your eyes. Oh, let me pop a wee bit on for you. It's once you start hitting the face with it, that's what happens. So I couldn't do it because I'd probably look at it more as a sales job, and it's not a sales job.
Well, on that note, thank you for tonight's chat, Verity. It's been really insightful, and I like the helpful tips as well, and great hosting, Gary, and well done, and thanks for coming on, Verity.
Thanks for having me. Great.